Welcome to this last day of September edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Ahead in the second half of today's show, North Dakota State University's historian Dr. Tom Ezern takes us back to the late 1800s when prairie residents faced down frightening mad dog scares, episodes of rumor, fear, and rabies that gripped small towns. And also later, rural America's internet future. Billions are on the way, but will quick fixes mean slow connections? Faith, fear, and fiber are all coming your way today on Main Street. As we begin Main Street today, we're excited to explore a remarkable architecture story in Jamestown, North Dakota, the University of Jamestown Historic Voorhees Chapel, built in 1917, is collegiate Gothic style. It has been long the centerpiece on campus. It's even listed in the National Register of Historic Places. And now, after more than a century, the beloved chapel has been renovated and modernized in a way that both preserves its heritage and adapts it for today's students. The project included restoring the original 100-year-old stained glass windows and attaching a brand new student center to the chapel, creating a blend of old and new under one roof. How did a team of architects then from the Arizona desert come to breathe new life into the chapel on the North Dakota prairie? We're about to find out. Eddie Jones is the founding principal of Jones Studio in Tempe, Arizona, and the lead architect behind the Voorhees Chapel renovation and its new adjacent Center for Faith and Life. He joins us to share how this unlikely collaboration came about to transform the historic chapel into a vibrant hub of campus life. Eddie, congratulations and welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. I would have asked the same question, how to affirm from the desert.
It's the obvious first question. How did you end up here?
Well, the gentleman that funded this project, Jim Unruh, wonderful man, happens to live in Phoenix, Arizona, and we're based in Phoenix, Tempe technically, but Phoenix. And he is a member of a Presbyterian congregation who hired Jones Studio, my company, to renovate their facilities. And it turned out beautifully. And Jim, of course, was on the building committee and he was part of the process. And he saw how, and I'd like to think that he saw how serious we took the process and our sincerity and wanting to respect what was there. But lift it up and bring it into the sunshine, so to speak. And so, unbeknownst to us, there was this university in North Dakota called Jamestown, and that he had graduated from and had the utmost gratitude for his education because he credits this university with his success. So he recognized that the chapel needed some love, needed some attention. And he recommended us to the president of the university. And he even flew us up here in his private jet to introduce us to the project. He wasn't sure we would be interested in it. Like, of course we are. And personally, speaking for myself, I love getting outside my comfort zone, getting into other climates, getting into other cultures, getting into other conditions that force me to think in a different way. So I welcome the opportunity. It all started with just the singular challenge of restoring and modernizing a 100-year-old building.
Let me ask you, it is an historic building, and I've had the opportunity to be here many times. Mm-hmm. My son graduated from the University of Jamestown, as did my daughter-in-law, and this building is steeped in history. It's an important part of campus.
Yes.
When you first saw the chapel, what went through your mind?
Well, because I did not, by definition, have any sentimentality towards it, I could be very objective. And I love the little building. I love the proportions. I love the detailing. But the interior was not living up to its potential. I knew there were elements that had sort of disappeared over the years. And that's not unusual. As the years go by, as the decades go by, and programs change and evolve, then the buildings need to adapt to that. And when they're piecemeal, the piecemeal adaptation just causes layering of insensitive, perhaps would be a good word, for the, you know, trying to bring it up to
done with the best intentions at the time.
Best intentions, yes. So my first thought is all we have to do is uncover what was original. And, you know,
did that turn out to be the case?
Yes, sir.
In what way?
They're the most beautiful, largest stained glass building in Voorhees Chapel was hidden from view from the interior. It was covered up by old, non-functioning organ pipes. You were completely unaware that it
sitting in the back of the church as you're looking towards the front.
Now, you know, that it is exposed. And to me, that made all the difference in the world. Acoustically, the chapel wasn't bad, but...
Is it better now?
Oh, yes. We just interviewed the choir director and a few choir members, and they were very complimentary. In fact, Rob and I have been here several days and have been able to visit with a lot of parents of students, a lot of students. And so far, it's been all positive, not one negative comment, which is very gratifying, by the way.
We're just in a basement area that essentially was an old, dark, decrepit store place, maybe.
I think might
be the right way. Now it's a beautiful, open connection to the student center. What was your vision when you first thought about this remarkable transformation downstairs?
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to Polly, the president of the university. She was thinking bigger than just the renovation of the chapel. She knew that her students deserved a place to socialize.
It was a vacant lot.
Yes,
essentially.
It was a vacant lot. And so to get from the student center to worship services, you had to go outside in the snow and the rain and all of that. And you know, I'm sure that discouraged some students from going here. Mm-hmm. And so she had this vision of making the connection. Well, how do you do that? How do you take a new building and physically attach it to an historic building? Not just an old building, but an historic building. One that was structured to support itself and not another building. And so all these challenges, all these constraints just sweetened the pie, as far as I was concerned. And I think there was one meeting where they talked about, you know, we're gonna have to build another building for classroom space. And we said, you know, guys, you have this huge, you know, underutilized space in Voorhees Chapel already. You know, why do you need another building when all we have to do is remodel this into a beautiful space that would lure students to it? Well, how do you do that? How do you lure students to a basement? Well, you can follow the logic, you know, excavating and exposing what used to be underground and connecting it to a sunken terraced amphitheater, miniature amphitheater, which you can ascend into the area where the food is, you know, that's a lure. It all worked together. But there's still the daunting challenge of connecting the enclosure of the new building and touching the historic building.
And what challenge is, because one building is on the National Register, the other's brand new. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges in doing that?
Well, we can talk about it in two ways. There are the structural challenges and the way that was solved, and it's very logical. You'll see it, it's exposed. This new addition is completely structurally independent from this building. But maybe that's the easy part. The harder part is the aesthetic sensitivity and balancing respect with new thinking. And I hope you'll agree when I take you out there into the sunken garden and you see how the roof echoes the radius of the stained glass, the beautiful stained glass windows, and how this facade, this east facade, which used to be an outside surface, is now an inside surface.
We're visiting with Eddie Jones. He's an architect and the founding principal of the Jones Studio, and he's lead architect behind the Voorhees Chapel renovation and its new adjacent Center for Faith and Life on the campus of the University of Jamestown. want to talk to you a little bit more about the stained glass. We've touched on it. How does one restore? How does one integrate? How, because these
you
are
hire a professional.
Important pieces to the history of the building.
Yeah, you hire a professional. We had really nothing to do with it. The university took the responsibility for finding a company that specialized in stained glass restoration. And our general contractor that built the building, their responsibility was to remove it, remove the frames with the stained glass without destroying the windows. And I have to say the end product is just glorious. It's so beautiful.
It is stunning. Yeah. This campus has endured a little bit in the last couple of years, a fire, a tornado and a fire.
Yeah.
We talked about that a little bit off mic. Did that at all impact the project?
Well, we were well underway when the first fire happened adjacent to the building. We received a call, you know, mid-morning in Arizona time, and it was in the middle of winter.
And your heart sank.
Your winter. And, well, there was no damage to our building. Miraculously, the fire was contained in time so that it didn't impact any of the new construction. What was remarkable for some desert rat architects is the photographs of the fire after it was put out. And it was one big ice cube. Man, it must really be cold up there for water to just freeze in a vertical plane. But so there was that. And because of, the aspiration to open this center and during Leadership Week, the university just hopped on the demolition and reconstruction of the kitchen part. They took the opportunity to expand it. We had our hands full doing this, so another firm took care of that.
With a project like this, recognizing that you're renovating, revitalizing a very historic place, is it hard to source materials to do what your vision is?
Well, I have to be careful here. It's not.
I can edit all of this out.
It's not about sourcing materials as much as it is about sourcing good craftsmen. And so there's a range of craftsmanship here in the building. Most of it is excellent. Some of it not up to our standards, but that's okay. I think this new building with new kinds of detailing in a northern climate, personally, and I think I speak for Rob too, that we hope that it will inspire the university to expect more from their architects and more from their contractors for future building projects.
Tough for you coming from Arizona to have the vision, make sure everything can work in this climate. Is that a challenge?
We work all over the world. Now you rise to the occasion, and it helps to hire local consultants too, that are aware of conditions and conventional detailing requirements, and it's a team. I mean, I'm doing all the talking here, and I should recognize that it was a very large team that pulled this together.
Have you had the opportunity to visit with students?
Yes.
Tell me what they're telling you. What does this mean to them?
They love it. They, didn't know it was possible, to have a spaces so full of light. More than talking to students, though, Rob and I have sat in a corner for the last 2-3 days.
Flies on the wall, so to speak?
Yes. And we watch where the students are choosing to sit and choosing to pause and have conversations. And we're high-fiving each other because it's working just like we had hoped it would work. And we laugh that, because we're from the Sonoran Desert, we tend to sit on the north side. But all the students, the first tables that fill up are the ones by the floor-to-ceiling glass facing south. They're in sunlight, and we just love that.
Well, Eddie Jones, it's a pleasure. We're going to learn more about the project aspect of this new construction or this renovation here on the University of Jamestown campus. Eddie Jones is the founder and principal of Jones Studio in Arizona.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're pleased to be joined by Rob Huff. He's the project manager for Jones Studio, who have been working now for the past 2.5 years, renovating and revitalizing the Voorhees Chapel on the campus of the University of Jamestown, and it is spectacular. So Rob, I know little about what a project manager does, but I'm guessing you take the architect's vision and you make it happen.
That's right. At Jones Studio, we collaborate really well between the management of the project and the lead designers, of course. Like, that's inseparably connected. And so Eddie and I did the master plan originally. I got flown out by Jim, like Eddie had mentioned, and spent a lot of time with the university faculty and the staff and all the different people that'll be using the space, and had really great workshops with them, really got down to what they needed out of the space. And ultimately, it falls upon me to make sure that the vision for the project is actually carried out.
Ever a moment when it's like, oh, I'm not sure?
Yeah, it's always tough when you start off with a fresh team where, you know, you've got the University of Jamestown with all of their great staff. Dustin Jensen, he was the lead front man at the university. And of course, we've got a great contractor, J.E. Dunn, that's done a whole lot of work around North Dakota. And so we brought that team together and started having conversations. And of course, you know, with the designs that we brought forward, they were innovative, and they were pushing the boundaries of what people were used to in North Dakota, as you can see. And a lot of questions about, well, should we really be doing this? And the more we talked about it, the more we had an opportunity to really convince them of the quality of the design, and we got everybody on board, and we started pushing ahead. And it was a great partnership all the way through. There were certainly a lot of stumbling is not the right word, but a lot of challenges that came up because of the historic renovation. But as a team, we all gathered together, put our heads together, figured out the right path, and we think the result speaks for itself.
Anything in the construction process where the whistle blew, everybody froze, and we discovered something we just didn't know was there?
Yeah, it's always challenging when you cut a hole in the floor and you find a lake underneath the ground, you know? And so we found all kinds of fun things. There was a 10-foot diameter hole that went about 30 feet down below the basement. Full of water, and of course we thought, well, we hope there's no bodies down there. That's a fairly large hole, and so we weren't quite sure what that was, and so we had to deal with that and fill it in and reinforce it. Found out that the traditional foundations that we would think would be underneath the chapel would be there, they're not. Turns out they basically just have a 4-inch slab all the way around, and it was built on top of that. So there's quite a few elements along the way that we had to reinforce to make sure that this chapel stands again for another 100 years next to its sibling here of the Center for Faith and Life that is now adjoined to it so closely.
What's your perception about what this building means to this campus?
Wow. It's been fun this week because we've had a lot of great opportunities to meet with alumni and students who experienced what it was like to be here at this chapel in the 60s and 70s, especially Jim Unruh, who graduated in the 60s. And he just tells us of all these fun experiences of being down in this basement when it was a dining hall, singing in the choir when it was up in the chapel, and to have these people come in and just be blown away by how beautiful and how appreciative they are of the work we've done. It really just warms our hearts that, you know, you always wait till the last minute to make sure it actually is as good as you think it's going to be. And it's really gratifying to realize that people appreciate the work as much as we do.
During the construction process, do you try to repurpose what you find, especially in a historical building? And did you ever intersect with, I really want to save this, but I can't, we're going to have to go a different way in this project?
That's a great question. Every single project, especially within the religious environment that we work on, we always try to find what we call artifacts that are really special to the heart of everybody that sees them, experiences them. But we try to repurpose them in kind of unique ways that might surprise people, but still they appreciate that we put the effort in to restore it. So a couple of things on this particular chapel. The first one was the pews. The pews were a hard decision to make. A lot of people were really emotionally connected to them. But ultimately with the school and our team, we decided that chairs were the right way to go for the flexibility of that chapel to make sure there's lots of different activities that could happen there. And so we wanted to repurpose those pews as much as possible. First thing that we did with the pews is there's a several of them that are actually in the cafe. They're up against the back wall on the glass, and so people can still come and sit on the pews and have a coffee. The next thing is we had a local woodworker actually break down some of the pews, refinish it, and there's a whole collection of St. John's Bibles that are on display now here in the chapel. In fact, there are going to be three of them. Two down in the lower garden terrace space and one up in the chapel. And the closure cases, the storage cases, are made out of the old pew wood. And so that has a really strong connection to the old chapel. And then also the cross itself that's hanging in the chapel is all been renovated pew wood that's now been repurposed for the cross.
When you talk about this building in the future, are there technologies in this building that are just super cool that obviously didn't exist when the building was built, but that will add to its sustainability?
Yeah, the more and more that we're moving into, you know, universities where people are coming from out of state to other states, it's always a challenge because if you have somebody from North Dakota, they're used to the cold, they're used to the different environments. But University of Jamestown is doing such a great job building up the character and the qualities of its students that it's attracting a lot of people from other states. And so one of the things we had to renovate was an air conditioning system that would operate all year long. The chapel used to just have a boiler that it would be warm during the winter, and then during the rest of the year, they'd open the doors and just go, that's exactly right. But now we have a completely state-of-the-art air conditioning system that's connected to controls, and so it controls humidity, it controls air conditioning, the whole bit. So that's a big element. And of course, we wanted to make sure that we had a good partner with the audiovisual, and so we've got a great projection system in there now, great audio in there. In fact, we were just witnessing the alumni choir was singing in there, and everybody was really excited with how good it sounds in the space.
Rob Huff, he's the project manager of Jones Studio here from Arizona, watching the dedication of the Voorhees Chapel Revitalization Project. Thank you, Rob.
Great. Come and visit. We've got a great cafe here, and so lots of opportunities to come and visit the campus and enjoy the great sunny spaces inside of this snowy North Dakota space.
Still ahead on Main Street, a prairie panic over rabies. Dr. Tom Ezern tells the tale of the mad dog scare, and from mad dogs to megabytes, why rural America's internet future could still be stuck in the slow lane. That's all ahead on this Tuesday's Main Street. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the late 19th century, rabies was both feared and poorly understood. Across the northern plains, mysterious dogs appeared, livestock sickened, and neighbors whispered about mad dog scares. Today in this Plainsfolk essay by Dr. Tom Ezern, we look back into two such episodes near Devil's Lake, where fear, rumor, and real danger tangled together in prairie life.
In the late 19th century, rabies scares animated communities all over the northern plains. Most were brief, and published reports lacked analytic detail. Certain episodes, however, attracted attention and produced documentation that gives us some insight into prairie community dynamics. Everyone knew something about rabies, often by experience or what they thought was experience. There was plenty of information, much of it erroneous. There was a vaccination available in Paris in 1885 and in America soon after, but I find only one record of anyone in Dakota Territory or early North Dakota availing himself of it. An intriguing report comes from Devil's Lake in May of 1885. The Inter-Ocean reported a mysterious dog had appeared in the neighborhood and bit some cows belonging to Ed Poole. The same dog then followed Harry Romney to Odessa, it says, and bit his dog, which 4 days later showed symptoms of the madness. Chained up, the poor dog got worse and had to be shot. It was a very valuable dog Harry had brought with him from Minnesota, mourned the local editor. A sad story, not too tragic, but notice the dynamic of what we today would call contact tracing. A mysterious dog attacks some cows, follows a farmer home to his farm, bites his dog, which sickens and has to be put down. Also notice the open ends of the narrative. The canine agent of infection just appears from nowhere, remains unidentified, and disappears, not heard from again. There was a more celebrated rabies case at Devil's Lake in the fall of 1898. Again, a mysterious canine, a strange shepherd dog, as it was described, appeared near the community of Bartlett and commenced snapping at horses, cows, pigs, sheep, and other dogs. It bit a cow at the farm of Ole Anderson and then bit his daughter, ran to the farm of a fellow named Thompson, who drove it off after it bit his cows, and proceeded to the farm of a brother, Andrew Thompson, who, finding the beast worrying his stock in the barn, killed it with a pitchfork. Word was sent to the state veterinarian in Bismarck, Dr. Wilton Crewe. Case closed. Not so fast. Farm animals began showing symptoms of incipient hydrophobia. Andrew Thompson had to kill several head of livestock, including a horse that exhibited the classic gnawing habits of a rabid animal, chewing up the walls of its stall, knocking out its own teeth. A neighbor put down a calf and a pig, still another a cow. Many farmers put down livestock acting suspicious, the papers said. Fortunately, the Anderson girl developed no symptoms. Meanwhile, at a farm some 20 miles away, Thomas Maloney, no doubt having heard of the uproar in Bartlett, killed his dog after it bit a mare. The mare then attacked a cow and a bull, and so Maloney killed the mare, too. More generally, the papers reported, there have been reports of strangely acting dogs having been seen in other parts of the county, constituting a well-defined mad dog scare. Then Dr. Crewe arrived, having hustled down from Bismarck, arriving at the Anderson farm to find a horse tied up to a wagon, acting strangely and thought to be mad, he said, refusing food and water, eating dirt, pawing and bellowing, finally commencing convulsions. Crewe ordered the animal dispatched. Then he gave a report to the press, tracing contacts, confirming details in sequence as they were known. Interestingly, there were no more incidents after Crewe posted his report. We are left to imagine the sensational reports that must have passed person to person across the county, the exasperation and anger of farmers having to put down livestock, and just why the local editor called the whole affair not an emergency, but a panic.
That was Plains Folk, written and voiced by Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history and a historian of the Northern Plains. You can hear his Plains Folk essays each week here on Main Street. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For years, rural America has waited for reliable high-speed internet. A massive federal program promised to help, but new rules from Washington now shift the focus to the lowest cost options, raising concerns that rural families could be left with slower or more costly service in the long run. Anna Pope for Harvest Public Media reports from Oklahoma.
I'm in the small town of Antlers, Oklahoma.
Hello.
Hi, I'm here to meet Chris.
Okay.
Chris Bailey works here at the Oklahoma State University Extension Office in Pushmataha County.
So, Southeast Oklahoma, we are very rural. We have small communities, which I love. Beautiful country. We have a lot of timber industry, a lot of farming.
Bailey helps connect farmers and families to educational resources. She knows a lot of people in this area don't have good internet. That includes Bailey's other office in a neighboring county.
It still is not good enough for us to upgrade our phone systems to an internet-based phone, and that's what we're really needing in that office.
For years, federal and state governments have been working to expand internet connection, especially in rural communities. In 2023, Congress allocated about $42 billion for states through the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, or BEAD, program. States were gearing up to start those projects, but then earlier this year, the Trump administration pressed pause.
We were days from announcing where we were, and then the rules change.
That's Mike Sanders, the executive director of the Oklahoma Broadband Office. In June, when the Trump administration issued new guidance, the office had to completely revamp the state's plan.
Where we had 8 to 10 months leading up to that, we had 90 days. Everything was condensed in a year's work, I kid you not, into 3 months.
Oklahoma submitted its final proposals earlier this month, but several other states, including Missouri, Texas, Illinois, and Indiana, needed extensions. In the new proposals, the Trump administration asked states to consider more types of technology and the lowest cost options. Drew Gardner is with the Benton Institute for Broadband and Society, which advocates for reliable and affordable internet nationwide.
So we're not going to be looking at sort of the best quality network. We're going to be looking at the least expensive networks.
Fiber optic lines have been the gold standard for years. Now, satellite and fixed wireless are playing a bigger role in the state's proposals. Those technologies are cheaper to install than fiber, but some question whether they'll be as reliable and long-lasting. In Wisconsin, Gail Hike, community development specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says initially the state was looking at 93% fiber in the program. Now, it's dropped to 73%.
We're hearing from communities that are concerned. What's that going to mean for sustainability? What's that going to mean as far as in some topography areas?
Satellite and fixed wireless beam service over radio waves, which can get blocked by trees, mountains, or a bad storm. Still, it's cheaper, meaning the whole BEAD program will cost less. But each state had an initial budget, and now it's unclear where leftover money will end up. Garner says it's up to the National Telecommunications Information Administration, or NTIA.
They are being very cagey about what they're going to let states do with that money. By law, it is the state's money. We're just waiting for NTIA to say what they can do with it.
In Oklahoma, Sanders says this federal money will help them connect broadband in the last, toughest-to-reach places.
When it's all said and done, I believe Oklahoma will be very proud with the product that we have produced. However, there's a big however here. Everything will now lie with NTIA.
The agency will have the final word toward the end of the year. Sanders hopes to have shovels in the ground next spring.
That was Anna Pope with Harvest Public Media reporting on broadband expansion across rural America. Harvest Public Media covers food, agriculture, and rural issues throughout the Midwest and Great Plains.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
If you believe in the mission of this station, but now's not the right time for a financial gift,
donate a vehicle you don't need instead. It's easy to do, and it could mean hundreds of dollars in support.
Learn more on this station's website.
Just go to prairiepublic.org, open the support tab, and choose vehicle donation.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In 2021, Chuck Sams became the first Indigenous director of the National Park Service. Now he has started a new role as the Director of Indigenous Programs at the Yale Center for Environmental Justice. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Sams about his work.
Can you talk a little bit about your background and your personal relationship with the land, and why did you want to do the work that you do?
My name's Chuck Sams. I'm an enrolled member of the Confederate Tribes, the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I'm Walla Walla and Cayuse. I grew up here on the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Northeast Oregon, and I'm very fortunate to have grown up with my grandparents on both sides, and in addition to growing up to a lot of elders who taught me the importance of the land, T'chum, and the importance of being a good steward of the land and the natural resources, and understanding that our own creation story tells us that, you know, my eyesight comes from eagle, my skin comes from the hide of elk, My entire blood system and nerve system comes from our relatives, the plants. My hearing comes from owl, and that my voice comes from salmon, and that we made a promise with the salmon that we Waikanishnaknuithluma, that we would be the keepers of the salmon, and that we would be then the keepers of the natural resources.
You have decades of experience working with indigenous land. What impacts from climate change have you seen, and how have things changed over the years?
You know, I was first introduced to climate change when I was very young, fishing on the Columbia River at Cascade Locks with my grandfather and my great uncles and their friends. And they talked about a time when the river still ran free. And they noticed the climate in the river was changing because of the water that was pooling behind the dams. We've seen over the last 100 years a great change here all across the United States and across the world because of industrialization. Native people have at least experienced 3 to 4 different types of climate change in the 30,000 years we've been in North and South America. And so our stories tell us about these times and how not only did we mitigate for that climate change, but we were able to find ways to thrive from it. And so I think we have a lot to learn from traditional ecological knowledge and indigenous knowledge that can help us combat climate change.
What are some successful models of partnership, and what can non-indigenous people learn from indigenous communities from their relationship with the land?
Some of them have had to be hard fought, and the Umatilla, the Nez Perce, Warm Springs, and the Yakima people of the Columbia Plateau had to go to court over and over again in order to ensure that our treaty rights were protected so that we could get to our not only our usual accustomed places, but that we could also co-manage these species, whether they be salmon, lamprey, bison, or wolves. And we've been able to show, though, that with state and federal agencies, that if we work together, we can actually restore these species. I look at Yellowstone and the work of our tribes jointly, along with the other tribes of the plains and the Montana region, to work together to bring bison back on the Yellowstone National Park and Gallatin National Forest. It's a hugely successful story.
You worked for the federal government under the Biden administration. Today, tribes are dealing with a very different administration. How are you seeing tribes respond to these shifting winds?
Organizations in the environmental field are having to get into this fight that tribes have been having to do since the days we've had to make treaties with the United States. And so the tribes are probably at the forefront and preparing to have this fight to ensure that our rights are protected. And so we're in a better position to ensure that our treaty rights are protected, not only with the current administration, but also in pushing Congress to fulfill their obligations under treaty and under law that currently exists.
Can you talk about your hopes and plans for your new role and how you think that work will fit in with the current situation with tribes and climate and the current Trump administration?
I'm building out a co-stewardship co-management cohort program that will help bring in graduate level students and juniors and seniors at Yale into understanding what it means to do tribal natural resources and how does that apply onto public lands and where that nexus is, so that we are preparing both native and non-native leaders for the future on how to better steward these lands now and for future generations. And so it's a very exciting time to be working at Yale and continuing the fight in environmental justice and working with tribes to help build their capacity as sovereigns to affect their stewardship responsibilities on public lands.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
Your dog's carbon paw print. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report,
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, at a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, many countries made commitments to cut back fossil fuel emissions to fight climate change.
China announced it would curb emissions by up to 10% by 2035, which was far lower than the 30% the Biden administration had urged the world's biggest carbon polluter to achieve. President Xi Jinping said they will ramp up wind and solar power, aiming to increase them sixfold over 2020 levels.
The U.S. is the world's second largest emitter of CO2, but Trump, for the second time, has pulled the country out of the Paris Climate Agreement that addresses global warming.
At the UN last week, a day before China made its pledge, Trump praised the benefits of fossil fuels and called climate change the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world.
Climate activist Bill McKibben wrote that given Trump's position, 2025 will be noted as the point when technological, economic, and political leadership passed from the U.S. to China in the span of just 8 months.
Despite the retreat of the U.S., global investment in renewable technology grew in the first 6 months of this year by about 10% more than the same period in 2024.
While the U.N. was discussing climate change, a new report showed that 7 out of 9 critical limits for Earth's health have now been breached.
The Planetary Boundaries Science Lab at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research revealed that last year, the boundary for ocean acidification had been passed for the first time.
Increasing ocean acidity is caused by the absorption of excess CO2 from the atmosphere, which is driven mainly by burning fossil fuels made worse by deforestation.
Acidification makes it harder for organisms like oysters and corals to build their shells or skeletons, disrupting marine ecosystems and potentially affecting food security and coastal protection.
Currently, the Institute says there are only 2 planetary boundaries still within safe limits, air pollutants and the ozone layer, successes they attribute to international action on aerosol emissions.
Some of the other boundaries that have been breached are shifts in temperature and weather patterns, changes in land systems like deforestation, and freshwater use.
Heat waves are becoming more frequent and intense across the U.S., so perhaps this summer you took a dip in a river to cool off, but according to new research, it might not have been as refreshing as it once was.
A new study from Penn State found that heat waves are happening in rivers too, and they're accelerating faster than and lasting nearly twice as long as heat waves in the air.
It's a surprising finding given that many rivers are fed by snowmelt and underground streams. But the team found that periods of abnormally high temperatures in rivers are becoming more common, more intense, and longer lasting than they were 40 years ago.
The increased heat puts stress on aquatic ecosystems and can also raise the cost of treating drinking water.
The team collected river data at nearly 1,500 sites in the U.S. between 1980 and 2022. They found that temperatures rose above 59 degrees Fahrenheit, a threshold that can stress many species, at over 80% of study areas for nearly 12 days per year. The places where the waters warmed the fastest were in the Northeast, the Rocky Mountains, and Appalachia.
The authors say climate change is driving river heat waves by raising air temperatures that heat the water and changing precipitation patterns that shrink winter snowpacks.
Low, slow-moving water holds less oxygen, creating dangerous conditions for aquatic life. The study adds that human activities such as dams and agriculture play a secondary role in shaping how and where rivers are most vulnerable to these impacts.
And finally, we've learned over the years that to have a healthy planet and fend off the worst effects of climate change, we need to lower our carbon footprint by reducing the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from our activities and in the products we buy. But have you considered your paw print, the environmental footprint of feeding your dog?
The University of Nottingham has, and they've released a new study saying that plant-based foods rather than red meat options are best not only for man's best friend, but also for the earth.
The researchers looked at 31 different types of dry dog food sold in the UK, from ones based in poultry, lamb, and beef to others that were vegan and vegetarian.
They found that plant-based diets for pets had the lowest impact across several measures: greenhouse gas emissions, pollution of soil and water, freshwater withdrawal, and the land needed to produce the food.
For example, they say if a Labrador Retriever were fed a beef-based diet for 9 years of its adult life, it would require 57 football fields of land to grow its food. A dog fed a plant-based diet would require just over one field.
Also, the plant-based diets were not inferior. A study the team published earlier this month found that vegan dog food provided similar nutrition to meat-based fare in terms of its protein, amino acids, and vitamins.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 30th. North Dakotans were crazy about aviation right from the very start. Early North Dakota aviators include Carl Ben Eielson and Bruce Peterson. The ladies of the state were not to be left out. Florence Klingensmith, known as Treetops, was the first licensed female pilot in the state. She made a name for herself on the racing circuit in a plane she christened Miss Fargo. In 1933, Evelyn Waldron became the first woman in North Dakota to earn a transport pilot's license. The Fargo Air Museum is where visitors can go to experience the magic of aviation. It's home to a rotating selection of aircraft displays, ranging from the earliest days of flight to the most modern advancements. The Wright Flyer, considered one of the most accurate replicas of the Wright brothers' first plane, introduces museum visitors to the birth of aviation. The replica was built at the museum in 2003 in honor of the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' flight. Visitors can trace the progress of aviation with planes like the Mustang, the most iconic American fighter plane of World War II, the Bell UH-1 Iroquois helicopter, known as the Huey, was used from 1956 to 1976. It transported troops and supplies in Vietnam. The museum has the cockpit section, and visitors are encouraged to climb inside. The exhibits continue through history to the most modern technologies, including an MQ-1 Predator unmanned aircraft. The museum opened to the public on this date in 2001, with just one hangar. A second hangar was added in 2014. Today, the museum contains a wide array of airplanes and exhibits, many of them interactive. While the original plan focused on warbirds, the museum's mission expanded to include experimental and agricultural aircraft. History and hands-on fun come together at the museum, focused on promoting aviation through education, preservation, and restoration. The museum invites visitors of all ages to explore the skies. There's a wide range of educational programs for both youth and adults. The museum offers interactive history nights inside the full-motion flight simulator, and you can test your own drone flying skills as well. The Fargo Air Museum is located at 1609 19th Avenue North. It's open Tuesday through Saturday and welcomes both visitors and volunteers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, NDSU President David Cook joins us to unveil the new Honors College, launching in the fall of 2026 with a bold focus on artificial intelligence and human progress. With scholarships for 30 students each year, the program tackles the ethical, technical, and social dimensions of AI and will also chat about current events impacting NDSU with President Cook. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.